decided not to say a word in media or make any kind of promises to European Union or to the German chancellors about having any enmity with any person. That is why he even abstained from voting in the United Nations.
Dr. Najmi, you've mentioned that India abstained from voting in the UN General Assembly resolution against Russia. So what does this suggest about New Delhi's foreign policy?
First and foremost, it suggests that New Delhi's foreign policy or India's foreign policy is independent now. We are not following dictates from any of the superpower or so-called the colonial powers of Europe. We are free to take our decisions. Nobody is going to influence us or our foreign policy. At the time of independence, our first prime minister, he suggested the idea of non-alignment and safeguarding the national interest of India first. And I feel that Modi, the current prime minister, he is following the same policies at the moment. It is in national interest that he is not criticizing the Russian or Ukrainian war, or he is not openly criticizing Russia for waging war on Ukraine. That is for our national interest. There were almost 141 countries which actually voted against Russia, and there were 32 countries, including India, Iran, and South Africa and China, who abstained from voting. And that is what our national interest told us or guided us to do, and which actually is a better policy. During 60s, 70s, it was again Russia who has been supporting India as a country, as compared to the USA or the Western alliances who have been supporting Pakistan at that time.
Dr. Najmi, India is fulfilling majority of its oil demand from Russia and has also been opposing Western sanctions on Moscow. So will it help in bringing the two countries closer, reducing the influence of the US in the region?
Yes, I feel that the American influence is on decline at the moment. Earlier, United States of America, they created Quad. Quad included India, America, Japan, and Australia, four different economies. India being a developing economy, Japan flourishing economy, Australia again flourishing economy, and the USA. They included India only to make Asia more stabilizing or to challenge China, another superpower in the making. So they tried to isolate Russia by doing that, and America wanted to extend its influence beyond the border. They wanted to have their influence over Asian countries also, and for which they found India as the best kind of partner at that time. But with the times changing, with the ongoing Russian and Ukrainian war, the Russia is actually selling oil at the minimal cost to India, and India is gaining a lot of profit by buying that kind of oil. So there is no point that India will be having any enmity or bad relations or sour relationship with Russia.
Last but not least, Dr. Najmi, now Germany wishes for a free trade deal between India and the EU. How is this agreement going to impact China's influence in the region?
Well, India is one of the largest growing economy at the moment, and according to World Bank data, the GDP growth of India is 8% at the moment, and it is one of the most thriving economy where different European powers or even US, they want to invest in these ventures. Besides, it is having a very good youth which is educated and which is employable. So they find a lot of venues of success when they come to India. But saying that, you cannot deny the existence and power that China is having at the moment in the industry, in the finances, or in the business, or in the trade worldwide. China's FDI, foreign direct investment, is much higher as compared to India. Their production powers is much higher as compared to India. They do not follow any labor laws. They do not follow any guidelines from United Nations or from the Human Rights Commission. They do whatever they feel like doing.
There you have it, Associate Professor in Political Science, Dr. Mehnaz Najmi from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, Miss. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Insightful Geopolitics tweeted, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz on visit to India. We want to deepen Germany's relationship with India. Some 1,500 and more companies operate in India. Germany is trying to push for a $5.2 billion deal to sell India 6 conventional submarines. Moh Mustafa Hossein said German Chancellor Scholz has tried to convince India's Prime Minister Modi to side with the West against Russia during a visit to the South Asian state, peddling the blame Russia for the food insecurity narrative. Prime Minister Modi, for his part, claimed that India is neutral. Divya Kochar tweeted, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz calls on the world for very clear stance on Ukraine while on a state visit to India, and also urged Indian techies to work in Germany. Nameless Cynic says, thought for the day, if the U.S. will not tolerate a strong Russia or China or even a strong Germany and EU, surely India has noted that, which explains why the Indians prefer to keep relations open with Russia for their defense needs and not the U.S.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Being one of the world's fastest growing economies, the expansion of trade relations and access to new markets is a necessity for India. Yvonne and India share a common outlook towards the development of the Chabahar port, which is expected to lead to regional convergence and growth. Being easily accessible from India's western coast, this port can help India access new markets. The development of Chabahar port will also help strengthen relations between Tehran and New Delhi.
Iran offers extensive and diverse economic attractions for India, the most important being the rich oil and energy resources, transit corridors, and the Chabahar port. The importance of the Chabahar port has increased following the unfair Western sanctions against Tehran. This has attracted the attention of countries like Russia and India for its expansion. New Delhi is seeking to cooperate with Russia, Central Asian and Caucasus countries through the framework of the International North-South Multimodal Corridor. During the 2016 visit of the Indian Prime Minister to Iran, a trilateral agreement was signed by India, Iran and Afghanistan to establish an international transit and transportation corridor. Following the agreement, India, in cooperation with the Iranian government, participated in the development of the first phase of Shahid Beheshti Terminal at Chabahar. However, there has been a significant delay from the Indian side in the development of the port. According to the deputy head of Iran Ports and Maritime Organization, now after 7 years of the agreement between Iran and India for the expansion of Chabahar port, only 25% of the work has been done. This delay from the Indian side has led to uncertainty in Tehran, making many political and economic experts suggest a multifaceted policy for Iran based on the formation of a consortium to attract foreign investment to the country.
Chabahar port is a cost-effective, reliable, fast, safe, and profitable route for trade exchanges. Located in two international transit corridors due to its strategic location, the port has the potential of being the connecting hub of the region. Chabahar is vital for India to reduce its dependence on the Suez Canal for transporting cargo to Europe. The port will also help New Delhi realize the envisioned international north-south transport corridor between India, Iran and Russia, establishing connectivity between Europe, Central Asia and India.
In addition to being a cost-effective, fast and a safe port, Chabahar is located in two international transit corridors, north-south and east-west, providing a sea and land route to Central Asia and Afghanistan via Iran's eastern and northeastern borders. The advantage of the north-south corridor for India is to shorten access to Europe and other countries. This route is about 7,200 kilometers and almost 60% less than the sea route through the Suez Canal, reducing the time of cargo transportation from more than 40 days to just 20 days. Chabahar port has the potential not only to become India's gateway to Europe, Russia, and other Central Asian countries, but also to change into one of the most important ports of the world. India has expressed its vision to transform Shahid Beheshti Port in Chabahar into a transit hub and connect it to Central Asia. The interests of the two countries in the development of this port can help in securing the economic and geopolitical goals of New Delhi and Tehran. The development of this port and the integration of Iran into the Shanghai and Eurasia Organization in the future will lead to stronger relations between Iran, India, Russia, and China.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by political analyst Mr. Dilip Cherian from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, what do you think are the main factors driving the trade growth between Iran and India, and how do you see this trend evolving in the coming years?
India's growth of trade with a whole bunch of countries has been on the upswing. India is a big buyer of energy, petroleum, and other forms of energy, gas. And the reason why we are doing that is because we need energy resources for the kind of growth that we are fueling. That's one part of trade. The other part of trade is, of course, Indian companies trying to export and Indian companies needing inputs for a bunch of things that are now being produced here. So in terms of trade, India is a growing trading player and Iran is a source of many of the items that India needs. India also finds Iran a potential market into which to export. And we have had traditionally very good links. So this is why you see the growth. And this growth is only going to continue, irrespective and despite whatever sanctions, global shifts that happen, India has in its trading mentality a space for Iran and countries like that.
Now, Mr. Cherian, the Chabahar port has been identified as a key area of cooperation between Iran and India. So how important do you think this port is to both countries and what potential benefits could it bring to the region as a whole?
Wherever there is a trade link between India and any other country, we have seen that where a direct port facility is available, growth is faster. As far as the new port is concerned, the fact is that this port has a special significance for India because it is something we have cooperated on. And I think that in many senses, there is a deeper link than the symbolic one as far as this port is concerned. Because India recognizes the strategic need to have what we call friendly ports in the neighborhood. This is initially going to be proven through a track record of higher trading volumes. And what happens then is that as far as shipping lines and shipping lanes are concerned, this becomes a route of traffic. And in addition, and this is the big strategic aspect of it. In addition, it ensures that as far as our sea lanes are concerned, they have importance not just for us, but for all our trading partners. Because besides the product that comes directly from Iran, there will be product which actually gets transshipped via Iran. And I think that, therefore, more countries get a vested interest in ensuring that these trade routes are kept awake, alive, and growing, irrespective of what other geopolitical factors may pressurize countries into changing direction, into moving, moving the most favored route, etc. My personal belief and my analysis as an economist has always been that trade always precedes flag. And therefore, in this case too, the fact that trade is growing allows the flags in both the ports or in that port and other ports in India to be freely exchanged in terms of as the commerce and the growth of commerce is concerned.
Now, Mr. Cherion, let's talk about the competition as well. China's development of the Gwadar port in Pakistan is seen as a potential rival to India's interests in the region. So how do you see the competition between India and China playing out in the context of the Chabahar port and broader economic cooperation between Iran and India?
The Chabahar port is significant beyond the China factor. For India, the China factor has grown in importance a lot over the last 5 years. China was never seen as the kind of, shall we say, active aggressor that it is being seen in India today. Having said that, though, we also have to recognize that the quantum of commercial trade between India and China has quadrupled even during the period of extreme tension. Now, as far as the port in Pakistan is concerned, while it may be seen as a kind of commercial threat to the Chabahar, importance in this region, for India, we are very clear that no Pakistani port and no port which is controlled and run on investments from China can be a port where we will have the same level of comfort. So I think that in terms of backing, as it were, Chabahar will continue to receive more and more attention from India, even as the Chinese aid gets underway. So in some senses, we already have a time advantage. And that time advantage is going to only solidify the kind of, shall I say, invested effort in keeping these trade routes as those important for us. In any case, the quantum of trade we do with Pakistan is not very high. And therefore, the port there will at best be of transshipment importance and not of direct trade importance.
Now, last but not least, Mr. Cherion, some experts have suggested that India's slow progress in developing the Chabahar port has created uncertainty, leading Iran to consider forming a consortium with other countries. So what do you think can be the reason for this delay on India's part, and how do you think the situation could be resolved?
Since I haven't studied this and what the current state of investments, progress, what the delays are, this is not an area that I'm going to comment on. All I can say is that India's commitment may seem that it's not moving at the pace it should. But that having been said, those are endogenous factors. And I think the basic philosophy and strategy remains consistent with what we've promised. And I'm sure that this will only be, I would call, a blip in the horizon, and we shouldn't worry too much about it.
There you have it, political analyst Mr. Dilip Cherion from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Groucho Marx tweeted, "Congrats, India, on setting up a trade route between Iran, Russia, China, and your brilliant move. May it multiply in all aspects to all your interests, your partners, and may it increase. And add more member states just to irritate the Uncle Sams of that Orionish planet in Ozone Zombie." Lakshman Sagar said, "India and Iran are in talks over long-term usage contract of the Chabahar port. The port gives India sea and land access to Afghanistan and Central Asia, bypassing Pakistan, and also acts as a gateway to the east and west of the Caspian Sea as part of the international north-south transit corridor." Economic Times tweeted, "Indian Minister of Ports, Shipping and Waterways, Sarbananda Sonowal, has recently stated that India and Iran are in talks regarding the terms of the primary contract for the extended usage of Chabahar port." Ashok Swain says, "Under Manmohan Singh, India had planned Chabahar port in Iran to counter China-controlled Gwadar port in Pakistan. In 2018, Iran invited China and Pakistan to join Chabahar port project, and now Iran is going to supply electricity to Gwadar port."
And that was our episode about the recent visit of the German Chancellor to India and also Iran-India relations and the significance of Chabahar Port. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. We must deal with Allah rather than ordinary people. Even the closest relatives and family members can't take the place of Allah. Our dear martyrs understood this important case and always had Allah in their minds. All our martyrs and disabled war veterans dealt their life with Allah and preferred Him over all their wishes. Between hereafter and this world, we must prefer the affairs that are related to the other world. More than 120 ayahs of the Holy Quran claim that the hereafter has priority over this world. If our priority in life is Allah, then we will reach sincerity. Also, if we always have hereafter in our minds, then we will be more patient in hard situations. This is what the dear companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam did on the day of Ashura. They tolerated the difficult situations because they know they will reach salvation in the other world. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
While Israelis protest against Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir's war on the judiciary, the High Court of the Zionist regime enables the occupying regime's use of torture against Palestinian prisoners. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye noted, before the current far-right government's war on the judiciary, there was a little covered news story out of the Zionist regime's Supreme Court. On December 29, 2022, the Zionist regime's High Court once again capitulated to the demands of the regime regarding the issue of prison conditions and the size of prison cells in particular. It granted the regime's request and extended, for the third time, the deadline for expanding the living space of detainees until December 31, 2027. In response to a petition by Israeli human rights organizations, including the Association for Civil Rights, ACRI, the Supreme Court issued an order in June 2017 to expand the living space of prisoners to 4.5 square meters, giving the Zionist regime's prison service an initial deadline of 9 months. In most Western countries, the size of standard prison cells ranges between 6 and 12 square meters, while in the occupied territories, it is less than 3 square meters. The ruling seemed to acknowledge the cruel, humiliating, and inhuman living conditions of the prisoners. In the opening statement of the decision, Judge Yitzhak Amit wrote that society is evaluated through its treatment of prisoners. He pointed out that depriving them of their freedom through imprisonment does not mean depriving them of their right to dignity, which stems from the prisoner's right to determine the minimum living space. However, despite this statement, the court approved maintaining these conditions for an additional 5 years, which then became 10 years from the initial judgment. In 2014, ACRI, Physicians for Human Rights, PHRI, and other groups petitioned the Zionist regime Supreme Court to address overcrowding in Israeli jails and prisons and compel the regime to immediately increase the living area of prisoners to a minimum 4.5 square meters as a temporary solution until it is raised even further as part of a long-term plan. The petition stated that prisoners are forced to spend hours of their day in bed without the ability to move or stand, and those sharing a cell are unable to stand or walk at the same time in the limited space. As a result, prisoners are often forced to carry out their entire daily routine in bed, including eating. It further argues that overcrowding creates suffocation in the cells, harms the health of the prisoners, and causes increased friction between them. It is far from the acceptable size in countries considered democratic and from the minimum adopted by international institutions to ensure reasonable, adequate living conditions that are mentioned in the 2012 report published by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Unfortunately, the situation in the Zionist regime's prisons has been the same for decades, but the regime has done nothing to offer solutions or make changes. In its 2019 to 2020 annual report, the Zionist regime's public defense warned of prison overcrowding and prisoner rights violations. The report described the existing prison conditions as a serious violation of human dignity. It criticized the narrow size of the prison cell at 2.5 square meters, asserting that it is too small for even one resident. The report reiterated earlier calls to immediately stop holding prisoners in these cells, maintaining that they are unfit for human beings. It further noted that the prison cell area today is less than half of the minimum approved by the Zionist regime's prison service, the main carceral authority, which specified 6 square meters as a reasonable amount of space. The public defense report further held that this matter not only affects the rights of detainees, but also violates the regime's obligation to refrain from cruel, inhumane, and degrading punishment, a basic standard of international law. On June 13, 2017, the Zionist regime Supreme Court ordered the regime to increase the minimum prison living area. To ease the implementation of these reforms, the High Court divided the process into two stages. The first would grant the regime 9 months to increase the living area for prisoners to 3 square meters, not including a toilet and shower. An additional 9 months from the court order to increase the living area further to 4.5 square meters would comprise the second stage. However, on March 5, 2018, a week before the deadline for stage one reforms expired, the regime submitted a request to the court to postpone the implementation for 10 years from the initial ruling to 2027. The regime argued that the compliance with the timeline established by the court would require a mass release of prisoners and endanger the public. The petitioners rejected these claims, arguing that the regime took no action to conduct new detention centers and restating the High Court's observation about the inadequate facilities, many of which were built during the British Mandate. It also opposed the suggestion of a public safety issue, calling these idle threats intended to intimidate the court. The court sharply criticized the regime's actions and initially rejected the regime's request. This compelled the regime to submit a plan to construct new wings for hundreds of security prisoners and an increase of administrative release that will result in the evacuation of about 1,000 places of confinement. In June 2018, the Zionist regime updated the court on its intent to use Saharonim prison in Negev Desert as an immigration detention center as part of the first stage of reform. As for the second stage of the ruling, guaranteeing a minimum living space of 4.5 square meters for each prisoner, by December 2018, the regime failed to make any progress on this matter, leading human rights groups to demand that the court force it to adhere to the letter of its judgment. In a notice issued on July 29, 2018, the Zionist regime informed the court of its plan to establish by the year 2026 new centers for housing prisoners interrogated by Shin Bet, the Zionist regime's security service. It also announced its intent to petition the High Court to amend its judgment in order to exempt Shin Bet facilities from expanding the living space for prisoners until 2027. Currently, Shin Bet's cell size is 2 square meters or less. The petitioners representing various human rights groups opposed the regime's request, arguing that this population should actually receive priority in the efforts to adapt prison conditions to the court's ruling, and that postponing the execution date of the ruling by at least 8 years is unreasonable.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Today we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dear listeners, Professor Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, and we have had this pleasure to have him in the studio. We, in this program, discuss your problems, questions related to the Islamic upbringing and different topics which have a very great deal with the Islamic upbringing of children. And the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad and his family, may peace be upon them. So, Professor, in our previous episode, we have been talking about the importance of teaching no to our children. How important is it to teach to our girl childs, like the daughters who are, daughters are mostly sober and they have a sober and accepting nature and obedient nature. When obedience goes overflow in a child, do you think there is where the problem arises, that he does not learn to say no?
If we're talking about girls, they need to be extra careful, exactly as you mentioned also, that girls are quite, and they are in the... In
easygoing, actually.
Yes, they don't take care of many, they feel very much...
They sometimes feel that they are obedient, but they don't actually realize that being obedient to each and everyone would make them... targets or victims of some worse things.
So they need to be able to understand things properly and analyze them, and to understand, what, as I said before, that it is important for them to know what is important for them to protect. They need to protect their modesty, they need to protect their chastity, they need to protect their honor, they need to protect their pride, they need to take care of themselves in the sense that they need to be protected as Allah wants them to be so. So that is very important. So anything which is going to harm their personality, is going to harm their honor, and it's going to harm their modesty, that needs to be, you know, they need to reject that. They need to say no to it.
Yeah.
And they should become strong in doing that. Sometimes they overdo that. I mean, things which are not problematic, they should not feel arrogant in that.
Yeah.
They should not be arrogant, but they should be very, open up to things which are allowed in Islam, which are okay with their family members, with their with people whom they can learn, their teachers, their whoever can teach them, they learn from them. But with the opposite sex, no, there should be some limits, there should be some prohibitions that they should take care of. And they should learn that from that early age. And they should be taught by their parents and their mothers especially. When it comes to boys also, it is important that they should learn how to behave with the opposite sex.
Yeah.
That is also important. I mean, sometimes we...
It's not just the girl child who should learn to say no, it's also the boys.
Boys also. And again, it may start, the training may start within the siblings. If they are children, boys and girls, they should know how to take care of each other and take care of each other's limits and boundaries. The boy should know what girls, where girls should be left on their own. Girls should know where boys should be left on their own. The limits have to be explained to them by their children, and they have to be observed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as we mentioned and discussed before, also modesty starts from home, where how we wear things, how we move about, how we, you know, walk, how we talk. These are all important things that have to be taught at home. And that can only happen in a family which is concerned with the pure life they have to live in this world as people who are obedient to Allah Almighty, have the love of Allah Almighty at their hearts. So everyone should learn how to love Allah Almighty and how to
be obedient to Him.
And fear His anger and His displeasure.
Yeah. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Once again, a very warm welcome. And we are discussing the importance of saying no, and that how important it is to teach that to our children. And Professor Nakavi is helping us. Yes, Professor, one of the research by Kids Health says that a child rather learns the meaning of no as early as 8 months to 12 months. So when he is very, very young, he learns the meaning of no. So when a child learns no as young as like that, then why it becomes difficult for us to teach no to our children? And what else are the consequences if they fail to learn, if they fail to say no in the society?
So that's a very good point that you mentioned, that a child learns to say no at a very early age. So he, as we say in our expression of faith, La ilaha illallah, There's no Allah other than Allah. So there's...
Well...
There is no God other than Allah. So there are two things. One is rejection of anything which is other than Allah.
Shirk, yeah.
So our religion, our expression of faith starts with saying no.
Yes.
So the essence of our faith is saying no to things which are not considered to be godly.
All right, which so are that's against very beautiful.
Godly. And saying yes to God, saying yes to Allah. So that is the basic ingredient of our faith and our love. So faith and love for things which are godly.
Yeah.
And no and rejection to things which are not so. They are against God. So if we are able to inculcate that, yes to everything which belongs to Allah, yes to everything, which pleases Allah, and no to everything which displeases Allah Almighty. So if that is the scale, if that is the measure, then we can gradually teach them to say no to things which are harmful to their well-being spiritually and physically, and yes to things which are beneficial to them, whether it is food, whether it is clothing, whether it is relations with the opposite sex, whether it is a relation with each other, between parents and children, and so on and so forth. Whatever is good, as I said, the ultimate truth, the goodness which is inbuilt in us, in our nature, is there for, we need to just bring that out.
Yeah.
We need to bring that natural goodness out into our lives.
Yeah.
Islam also wants that. Islam's rules, Islam's laws, legislations, Sharia, it is for the sake of bringing out the goodness in us. So as everything is inbuilt in that nature, in the fitra that Allah Almighty has created, goodness is there, ultimate goodness, ultimate beauty. And this needs to be brought out. So if we are able to inculcate that love of Allah, automatically anything which is against Allah will be rejected.
Yeah. So it's very important, and it seems that if a child does not learn to say no, many tragedies would actually come into his way as he grows up and as he faces the society. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Nakavi, and we are discussing the importance of saying no. Well, Professor, in our previous episodes, we discussed obedience. And don't you think obedience is one of the things wherein, if not taught properly or if taught excessively, like a child learns to say yes instantly, this is also one of the reasons why a child is not able to say no as he grows up?
Yes, basically there's a clash between what our feelings are and what we think logically or rationally. We need to manage that conflict. The conflicts which take place in our lives emanate from the conflict from within.
Okay.
So on one hand, we have our intellect, we have reasoning, we have logic. On the other hand, we have feelings and emotions.
Emotions.
So we need to manage those emotions according to things which we logically understand to be correct and true. So if we are able to do that, and we are able to teach ourselves and manage our feelings and make our children manage those feelings according to what our logic says, then we can overcome all these difficulties. Then we can be able to say no. Normally, when we want to say no, we feel weakened by the fact that we are ourselves doing these things which are not, should not be done. So it becomes difficult to say no. If I'm saying no to my child and I'm not refraining from doing that myself, then I feel bad about it.
Yeah.
And I feel weakened by the fact that I would say, look, I'm doing this wrong thing, so let him do it. Say yes. And instantly we collaborate with him in doing that wrong thing.
Yeah.
So sometimes it is that our logic.
Saying instant yes.
Yes.
And sometimes it's emotionally, a conflict.
It's a conflict. The yes is emotionally charged. It's not logically backed.
Logic has no back or, you know, interference in this. So the problem, what we have deduced out here, the problem that as an adult, you're not able to say no, especially if you're a girl child and you're not able to say no where you are supposed to say no, is because there's a conflict within you between the emotions and the logic, and emotions actually get dominant over the logic part, and that's how you say yes to something that you yourself are saying no to. But here, Professor Nakavi is telling how important it is to say no, because if no is not said, then you yourself can become victims of different kinds of things. So, Professor, we have a very few minutes. Would you like to suggest some more thing on the topic?
Nowadays, today, one of the places where we need to say no and learn to say no is the social media.
All right.
Now, today we have so many social media applications, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and these are the places of this test and trial that we face on a daily basis. And you're going through Facebook, you're going through Twitter, you're looking for things which interest you. But unfortunately, here pops up a figure, a photograph. You become attracted to it. Look at it.
Yeah.
But if you are at the very moment that it has just flicked up and popped up in front of you, you would say no. Then it will go away.
So your logic over here.
But if you continue to look at it and engage yourself and engross yourself with it, the
more
you will be seduced and you will fall into the trap.
And then when things become very used to, there occurs a thing which is called as desensitization. Then it becomes very normal and usual.
Exactly.
And when things become usual, it is really very difficult to come out of all those things, and it's really very difficult to handle that situation. Anyways, Professor, we have learned very, very important things today and the importance of saying no. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much for helping us with your thoughts. So, dear girl childs, especially I'm referring to you right now, you gotta listen to this episode so many times because we are very sober and kind, and we feel our emotional part is always dominant over the other parts. So learn to say no where you want to say no, where you're feeling to say no, and our yes and no should be based on the choice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not what people think. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.